Welcome back to another fantastic episode of Cinema D'Amore. I'm one of your hosts, Justin Morgan. I'm here with
Chuck Phillips.
And we're going to be talking about the Coen brothers' No Country for Old Men. One of their more lighthearted films, I'd say.
Definitely.
Right up there with Raising Arizona.
Laughs every minute.
There is comedy in it, I feel. It's almost completely devoid of it. It doesn't have like a comic relief character, but there are moments within the serious bits, I guess, that kind of are comical.
Kelly MacDonald's mother is the comic relief,
I guess.
That's your comic relief, that one scene with her in it.
I mean, but if you think about the context of what she does, she essentially leads to the murder of another character. I don't know. The funniest thing I think is, and we're jumping more into the middle of the movie, but when Shigar like shoots that lock off the door and it hits Lewin Moss because he's standing there waiting for it or sitting there waiting for him. I don't know if it's supposed to be funny, but it has like a comic moment to me at least. But then it gets right back in the seriousness, which I think it's more Josh Brolin's face that just sells the what the fuck was that? Like, what just happened?
He's good as a leading man in this kind of... It's obviously a noir western. They definitely have those elements. The entire setup's a noir setup of a guy, you know, just kind of stumbling into something that he's not supposed to be involved in and just keeps getting deeper and deeper into it because he doesn't know when to stop or when to just kind of give up and get out, which he's given multiple opportunities to that he doesn't take because he's dead sure that he can get this figured out.
It's also another, like, I don't know if it's just the format of the story. Definitely the cinematography. Almost the entire story is visual. There's dialogue in the movie, but for the most part, as an audience, you can follow it for like 20 minutes of zero dialogue and completely understand what the hell's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, because he, like, even that opening scene when he goes out, he's hunting some sort of deer, gazelle type thing. I don't know what the fuck they are, but he's hunting them. Whatever. I don't know what we're used to Pennsylvania. All I know is white-tailed deer. I don't know anything beyond that. What else is
Texan deer? There.
Yeah, whatever they hunt in Texas, I guess. And he's out there hunting and, you know, comes across what is clearly a drug deal gone wrong. And he even kind of, like you're saying, how it's visual. Because yeah, he doesn't say it like really loudly. Like he does kind of talk to himself, but it's almost just like kind of mumbling under his breath. Like I'd go this way, and you got to go that way. And you don't even know what he's talking about until you figure out that the whole time he was trying to figure out, because he says like there's got to be a last man standing. Like there has to be someone that walked away from this. Like you couldn't have all just killed each other here. Someone had to have walked away from this. And that's what he's trying to get to. And it is great the way that they film that and just show him. And yeah, he doesn't just flat out. I feel like, yeah, in like a worse movie, he would like very loudly, like say to the camera, like, now, if I was to leave a crime scene like this, I'd go that direction and I'd walk this way. But he always just mumbles it under his breath. You could barely hear what he's even saying.
I watched it with subtitles and I don't think they give him dialogue for most of his mumbling.
I wouldn't be surprised because I think it is like it is obviously an intentional thing of they don't really want you to necessarily hear every single detail that he's saying. You just know that he's got something figured out and he's trying to work it out in his head.
Everything leads brilliantly into the next thing in this movie. Every like the prime example is where when it starts, even the exact moment that you're talking about, he's hunting. He shoots the deer / elk and he starts to follow the blood trail because he only wounded it. He didn't kill it on sight. And then he finds that like injured, he sees that injured pit bull. It's like, we know he didn't shoot a pit bull. And as he gets closer, you see this, I love the way that it's set up too, where you see it from far away where you can tell like it's unnatural in the landscape. You can tell that there's cars there, but then when it gets a closer, such as like through his binoculars, which isn't even close enough, but just a little bit closer where you can see like bodies and stuff laying around. Obviously, there was this great shootout, and I kind of love that idea of he's not necessarily a detective, but he's the best thing that we have at that moment. And the movie doesn't really try to piece anything together beyond the fact that I think the best thing that they probably do, and maybe it's the least educated thing for the audience, is that all those drug runners drive like the exact same truck. So whenever you see that truck, like that make and model of the truck, the Fords, you know that it's one of them. Like it comes back into play like later at the end of the movie where one race is off. It's the same truck again.
They get a discount at the car dealership when they buy in bulk.
Yeah, they just do like multiple. They just do multiple colors.
I'm gonna need 30 Ford trucks.
But yeah, everything. Obviously, it's a drug deal gone wrong, and I kind of like the idea that like, what would you say the main three characters are gonna be? Josh Brolin's Lewin Moss, Javier Bardem's Anton Chigurh, and then Tommy Lee Jones. I don't even know his name. Like the sheriff of the area.
I know. They just keep, most of people just like refer to him as sheriff, but I can't think of what his actual character name was.
But I basically like how a lot of the moments intertwine between them, and they're all pretty smart characters. So they're all like around the same. They figure things out pretty much exactly the same. So when you got that opening scene and Lewin's come across this drug deal, which essentially is just a bunch of bodies and cars, and he finds the one guy that is alive, and the guy's asking for water, and you know he knows that he, like you said, he makes that one line like where's the last man standing, which is probably the only thing for the audience, because I'm sure the guy that was shot and in his car all night knows exactly where the last man standing went. I love all the cocaine that you see that's like underneath that car and like in the bed of the truck,
which he's not interested in because he obviously thinks that the guy that left must have the money that was part of the deal, because that was probably the only part that he could carry away. He couldn't carry away like that looks like hundreds, almost thousands of pounds of drugs. Like there was no way he's taken that by himself. So he had to have just taken the money.
Assuming that there's money and the two characters that don't know that there's money, Lewin and the sheriff, are like 100% sure. They're like, there has to be money. I think they brought money. I don't think that it was like a deal went bad because the money wasn't here.
Yeah. He does another smart thing where, then again, he doesn't like spell it out, but you get what he's doing when he does finally come across that guy, out under the shade of a tree. Then he takes off his watch and he just sits there and looks at it to like time, like, you know, a few minutes to see that he never moves from that spot. Like his foot doesn't even twitch at all. Like just to be 100% sure, like, yeah, he's probably dead. Like he hasn't moved and he's either dead or he's like unconscious completely.
I like that he switches to the Uzi that he picked up for that guy. He's like, I guess he assumed he had more firepower or something. So he's like, that's what he went up there with. All these moments, I think they just keep building upon themselves and they get better and better. And then this movie is also notorious for not showing you everything. And like, I think the very first hint that you see is when it finally becomes the crime scene, which is after like two occurrences at the same place. Like the drugs are already gone. By the time the sheriff shows up, they show that bed of the truck and there's not like a single pound of drugs in there. So there's no drugs and there's no money at that point. It's just bodies and the pit bull and the dog that they keep pointing out.
God damn, they even shot the dog.
But do like what gets our lead, I guess he's considered the lead in this. There's really, I mean, I don't know. Anton Chigurh is probably like has the most screen time.
Yeah, but Josh Brolin's still he's the character that you're supposed to root for because you want him to. You want him to get out of it. So it's like, that's where I always put him more as the main lead, only just because he's the one that you actually want to get out. Because he's obviously not a bad guy. I know where you were about to start saying the thing that undoes all of his plans is that he's actually trying to do something good, which is like
the one thing that he does that is good.
That he tries to help someone and that's what gets it for him.
Yeah. It's, which I think is kind of clever because, I mean, obviously, we talked earlier about a simple plan, and this kind of comes close to that, where
very similar in the character, just coming across
a similar money. Plan.
Yeah, a similar plan. Yeah, coming across all that money, and he more or less has the same thought as like Billy Bob Thornton of, well, they're not gonna miss it. Like at first, that's what he seems to think. Like, yeah, they're probably not gonna miss it. I'll just take it, and we'll be fine.
Yeah, I think it's the same mindset of no one's going to know that I have it. No one's going to figure out it's me. Yeah. But when he goes back and it's like dusk, it's such a great moment too, where I don't hear anything in the sound, but he like looks over his shoulder, and then there's a second truck next to his truck, and they slash his tires, and they start driving, and they start chasing him down. And now he's done fucked up because he drove to the scene. And his truck is there. Even the sheriff, when the sheriff shows up the next morning, he's like, that's Lewin Moss's truck. Like, he didn't even have to run plates or anything. It was just, like, instinctually he knew exactly who in his town's truck that was. But, like, yeah, I think everything plays out wonderfully. I do feel like it is very complimentary to Fargo. It's just, like, it's like the Texan Fargo, I guess.
Yeah, there's definitely connections there. Or yeah, almost at some point the money isn't even really the main factor for what anyone's there for. And multiple characters even say, like, I don't really care about the money. Like, it just starts to become they just want to battle, as Woody Harrelson puts it, just on principle alone, that you've inconvenienced this man. Who, yeah, he has a ton of great moments. Javier Bardem just by himself, just like really giving you like his insight into everything, and like how out of his mind he is. We do see, you know, when he first gets picked up by that cop, and the cop's real confused on what that thing is that he has with him. He's like, he calls it in. He's like, I don't know, some weird, you know, can, like an oxygen tank. Yeah. It has like a tube. He's like, I don't know what it is. and that whole scene's played perfectly with when he's in the background, you know, getting his hands under his legs to get the cuffs in front of him, and you could just see him.
Good horror element.
It's a perfect moment of him just in the background the entire time, and then he attacks him and then kills him, and then we finally get to see him use that thing when he pulls the guy over with the.
Well, even before that, I really like the murder scene, not just how it goes down, but like you get the sound effects of the shoes on that floor.
Yeah.
And I feel like it makes the crime scene so much worse when you see all the marks that he made up on the floor from just his shoes, from just that moment. It makes it like such a more violent crime. But yeah, you can continue. When he now, the brilliant Coen brothers have this serial killer in a police car.
Yeah, so he's got, yeah, you know, he's got to ditch that. But and sometimes you get those kind of like fun moments of like when it almost all depends on his mood. Like, does he have time to like mess around with the people, or does he just need to kill them? So he just pulls that guy over. He's like, I just need you to step out of the car. He's like, and just stand right there. And he holds that thing in front of him and just shoots him in the head with it, and then just drops him and just leaves. But then, yeah, later on, we get that other scene with him, with the guy in the gas station, who he's like, he keeps creeping that guy out because he's just so weird and unsettling to be around.
Can I help you with what?
Yeah. But he just keeps like he's standing there every question. Like, so he's just eating that bag of peanuts the entire time.
I think it's also costs, a very,
I have to say, they cost 69 cents. So it's the same bill as the dude.
Yeah. I didn't even think about that. I didn't make that connection. So bravo. It probably was a throwback. They're like, it has to be 69 cents. I don't know if that's accurate.
That's also the only scene that tells us what year this movie takes place. Do you know what year it is?
Yeah, but it's not the only one. Well, unless there was a time jump, because when what's her face's mother dies, when the mother-in-law dies.
Oh, yeah, that is true.
They do show it on the tombstone also.
Yeah. Because it's
I would have thought 70s from watching it, which I guess it kind of fits because it's like, just 1980.
Yeah, 1980. Yeah, yeah. Because he tells him that the coins, when he gives him that moment, like, what's the worst or what's the most you've ever wagered on a coin flip? And the guy's like, I have no idea. And he's like, then he flips the coin. And he's like, what date's on the coin? The guy's like, how should I know? He's like, 1958.
What I really like is that he has that mentality of the serial killer that has to be the smartest guy in the room and likes to show off how smart he is, because he's extremely demeaning to that guy.
Yeah.
Who, like, I don't know. I guess simpleton, like, he's not dumb, but like he lives this simple life where he's just happy running the gas station.
What time do you close? I don't know when it gets dark. He's like, I asked you what time you close. Don't you know what time you close? Yeah, he just keeps going.
I like when he's like, when he asks if it's like been in his family, and he's like, oh, his wife's family.
So you married into it.
He's like, it's insulting. Yeah, like, you married into this gas station.
And he's like, I guess if you want to say that. And he's like, well, that's what it is. Yeah, but he just keeps giving him.
Another great thing is, though, I guess we've seen him murder two people at this point. Tommy Lee Jones's opening monologue is about these murders that he's, like, these crime scenes that he's seen where these people just have no compassion and they don't care if they'll, essentially, they don't care what the consequences are, even if they knew they were going to hell.
Yeah.
And then you have this, like, coin toss scene, so you know exactly what's on the line, even though that guy's, you know, I'm sure he's fairly certain his life's on the line. After talking to him for so long.
I mean, yeah, he knows he's weird, and he knows he's, you know, somebody not to be messed with, I guess. But yeah, when he does flip the coin and he calls it, and I just love his line, don't put it in your pocket. Where do you want me to put it? Anywhere but your pocket. Because then if you put it in your pocket, it'll just become a piece of change. And then he just goes, which it is. And then just leaves.
Yeah, it'll just become another coin like everything else. It won't have any importance to it.
Yeah,
there's a couple people that he kind of, the only one that he seems to like, I don't think he kills, the woman that works at the trailer park home.
Yeah, like, I think the only reason he doesn't is because somebody else is there, and it starts getting too messy when there's like multiple
there is
people.
One moment where the person like coughs or something, and he does look over. I don't think they even show what that person is. Just like,
you know there's someone else there. Yeah, like probably her husband or something like that, maybe.
Yeah, and it's like you could tell she's uneased by him, but she also has that like sternness that he doesn't really get from any other character. I don't think
she's one of the few characters, other than maybe Llewellyn Moss, that like kind of like tries to stand up to him and you know is like, I'm not scared of you. Like, you're weird, but I'm not scared of you.
Yeah, I don't even know if Llewellyn Moss isn't scared. He doesn't show it, but I feel like he's mostly like a survivalist, not just from like the hunting, but his thing with Shiger seems like he's got to take him out or before he gets murdered by the guy. Like he's just too dangerous. Just like the way that they move around. It's just, I don't know. I think it's kind of brilliant the way that the time setting makes things more difficult, obviously, than today's times, but they're able to kind of track which direction these characters are going. I don't know. The Coens really do a good job at making almost every character smart. Some are obviously smarter than others, but like there's so much detective work that's just happening. And even if it's a smaller character, like the one that runs the sporting goods store that Llewellyn Moss keeps buying stuff from.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, like he knows it's weird, but he points out that it's weird, but he still sells them like clothes. And I do like how he buys his socks earlier for his wound, and then later when he comes in like in the hospital scrubs, he's like, your guy sold me the socks. He's like, I'm gonna need everything else.
There's a lot of I like the way they set up the when he goes to the hotel. Like, kind of how you're saying, like, everyone's pretty
Which
smart.
Hotel?
Yeah.
Which
the first one he goes to.
Like, three hotels in the movie.
Yeah, the first one he goes to, the motel.
Yeah.
And he hides the cash in that room. Then we see him come back later. And again, like you were saying, he recognizes that truck that's sitting outside. So he knows they're
there. Yeah, that's the one model knows, truck they have.
He knows they're there, the guys that are looking for him. And I would still say, at this point, he probably doesn't realize... Like, he doesn't realize Anton Chigurh is after him at this point. He thinks it's just these guys in the truck, because he still hasn't run into him specifically yet. He just knows that
he's about to.
These guys are looking for him, and that's done very well, the way that the way that everyone kind of comes at it. He sees them, then he goes to the, when he goes to the motel desk, can you give me a map of your rooms? And he wants the room on the exact opposite side of his room. And she's like, you could have the room right next to yours. It's open. And he's like, no, I want the room on the other side. Also, that he can pull the money through the vent ducts that he put up earlier. So he has it on the other side. That Anton Chigurh has been driving around with that transponder, waiting for it to go off. And it finally starts beeping right at that hotel.
I do like, just like, it's such a simple but tense moment where he just starts backing up, and it's like right on Lewin's room that he has. And I mean, we find out pretty early that there's a tracking device, you know, in the bag of money, which I think is kind of clever too, because once Lewin's on to that idea, this is at the second hotel when he realizes this is too good. He's obviously being tracked somehow, and he finds the money that, like, they put ones in so they could cut through it, and they cut out a space so they could hide that thing in it. I thought that was pretty good too, because it's a pretty big transponder, so it's not like it would just squeeze or be hidden between the bills.
Yeah.
But yeah, that moment is great. I think that's like the most tense moment probably in the entire film, just because there's so much going on. Like, you don't know what's going on in Lewin's room, but you know there are people in it. And then he's trying to be quiet, and he's trying to get his get the money from the other side of the room. And then next to them is where Anton Chigurh sets up, and he's like practicing murdering people. Like, he's getting the layout of what the room is probably like next to him. And yeah, I just like, I like his weapon too.
Silence shotgun.
That massive, like, can on the end of it to silence it.
Yeah. And it's like a cool sound. It almost sounds like a laser gun when he shoots it.
I don't know. It's like one of those things that it's more fun than it should be. Like, as he goes in and he pops the people off. But yeah, he takes out those people, and that's the moment where Lewin's on the other side, and he's like, what the fuck is going on over there?
He could just hear like people falling over, like hitting the walls over there.
Yeah. I mean, he can hear some sort of sound, I'm sure, because he's right in the air duct. But I like how after he basically escapes, and Chigurh's like, he's basically casing the room to try to figure out where the fuck this is. And then this is where you realize that, like, he's just as smart as everybody else, because after he takes off the air ducts with one of his coins, mind you, he sees that he knows that the money was in there, and he knows that it was pulled through to the other side, because he knows it was in there whenever he drove up and he was practicing and stuff. So he knows that there's this other guy, and he's got to follow the money.
Yeah.
I think it's brilliant. And it comes together at like the very end of the money, or movie, Jesus Christ, comes together at the very end of the movie with like a very simple shot of like a register screws and a coin just laying there.
Yeah. Yeah. The coins are, like he says, the coins could just be pieces of change, or they could be, you know, anything that he needs them to be, I guess.
I got here the same way the coin did.
Yeah. Yeah. I also like, and I feel like this is, the Coens love to use, like, this movie could have probably been set in present day. It really could have probably been set anywhere, but they do, I think it helps that they set these movies, even if it's just like 20 years earlier, just so that they can have kind of those limitations. Although the book's probably also set there too. I wasn't thinking about that either, that the book was probably set in the 80s anyway. But like, it works well. Like, I think anyone watching today, like the way he's able to just walk across the border into Mexico,
mm-hmm.
is like, you know, that's like not like, you can't just like walk across and just like hold a beer and wave to the guy at the border and just be like, I'm just walking into Mexico. Like, this is just what we do now. Like, definitely.
We just let drunks go through. We don't care.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely had to
I like
this,
the
like,
money being
pre-9/11 or something like that. Like, you couldn't do that now.
he talked to be safe, because he has to go to a hospital. He tosses the money over the bridge, and I just think it's funny that like it didn't bust open. I'm thinking of Kubrick's The Killing or something, where it like falls on the tarmac and all blows around. But then you have Woody Harrelson's character, probably was back then. Woody Harrelson's character is just as intelligent, because he meets Lewin in the hospital and knows he had to stash the money somewhere. And it's as simple as he sees the poles and it's like, the only way to get it over this fence, he'd have to be up on this barrier. And he's only going to like get on the barrier by one of these light poles. And that's how he ends up like locating and seeing exactly where the money is. And it's another thing that's totally visual. It's not like a dumb detective serial where he's saying all the things that I literally just said, and I'm saying it because we're a podcast and you're listening to us, but visually it's all told visually. And I just think that that is great.
Yeah. Woody Harrelson's got a great character, even though he's only in a few scenes there, but they don't necessarily tell you everything about these characters. Like he's kind of just a mystery as to who he is, but like you obviously know that he must be just as intelligent and just as much of a killer as Anton Chigurh, because when Steven Root, when he has that scene with him and he meets him in his office and he's like, oh, you know, you must think it's a big problem. You called me. Like, so he definitely thinks of himself as just as intelligent, if not more so, or that he thinks he at least like, he doesn't have like a fake. He kind of like implies that he thinks Anton Chigurh's like morals are like some sort of warped, like psychopath thing. Like
he's not wrong.
He's just like, but he just like flat out is like, yeah, I kill people for money. Like that's just what I do. I don't have like a weird, like, oh, I'm doing the right thing, or I'm not a psychopath. Like he basically, Anton Chigurh seems to always get like kind of, he does get like that look in his eyes of being offended the few times that the characters talk to him and go, I knew you were crazy when I met you or something like that. And he kind of gets that like moment where he's like, he is offended that someone called him crazy. Like, he's like, I'm not crazy. Like, what are you talking about? Like, there's nothing crazy about me. Like, he's clearly been told this multiple times throughout his life. Like, you're crazy. And he's like, I'm not crazy. Like, this is just what I do. And,
he's slightly offended.
Yeah.
Like, it's like the Dark Knight Joker when he calls him like insane.
Yeah. And he gives him, I do like how he tells Llewellyn Davis, stop. I knew I was going to do that at some point because they had to use that same stupid name twice. Llewellyn Moss, not Llewellyn Davis. I feel like, were they just making this movie? Like, that's a good name. Maybe we could make one of our main characters that and put it in the title of the film. When he tells him in the hospital, like, you know how he found you? Yeah, I know how he found me. He's not going to find me again. And when he just goes, it took me like 3 hours to find you. Like I found you real easy, and he's just as smart as I am. Like, trust me, buddy, he's going to find you. If I could find you, he 100% knows exactly where you're at. And he already knows in advance. Maybe he'll go to Odessa. Why would he go to Odessa? He's like, man, don't insult my intelligence. Like, we know that's where your wife is. Like, we know where you live. We know where all your family lives. Like, he'll go kill your family if you don't just get this done with.
Right. And then like the drug dealers themselves, the cartel or whatever, they basically find out from just straight up like inquiring with his mother-in-law.
It feels like they're like more old fashioned. They're just like, they do it a little bit differently than these guys.
Mexican in a suit. You don't see that.
Yeah.
And then he's like, what, where are you headed? And it's like this, oh, I'm on this bus line. Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. I know El Paso. Yeah. Which way are you going?
Yeah, she's like, I don't know why I had to uproot my life to, like, go here. You know how many people I know here? Zero people.
Yeah, but he definitely, and then, Anton Chigurh definitely knows he has to eliminate Woody Harrelson, even though he kind of tries to, like, plead for his life, like, I can...
Well, even his wife, Carla Jean, like, to me, she also seems very smart, but she seems maybe less educated. She's piecing it all together, and... Even like towards the end when she basically has her run in with Chigurh, she knows what's happening. And she essentially calls him out on, you know, this isn't a thing of chance. This is your choice before she eats it. Everyone pretty much eats it.
Yeah.
And if they live, they like they still kind of do.
But another thing, like you were saying, once he goes back across the border into America, and he seems to have, you know, he thinks he has this big plan to lure Anton Chigurh to his death. He just constantly thinks that he can get the upper hand, like it'll just take one thing and he'll be able to beat him. But he doesn't plan for the Mexicans showing up in their trucks. That's a great cut. I love the way they edit that whole scene together of him just kind of casually walking down. He's like walking around the hotel waiting for someone to show up. He's got his gun strapped over his shoulder in some like weird case. He's literally just walking around with a shotgun on his back, and he meets that girl, and she's like, flirting with him, telling him like, "Oh, get some beers." And he's like, "No, I'm married." And she's like, "Come on, it's just some beers." And he's like, "No, I know where beers lead to." And she's like, "They lead to more beers." And he just kind of like laughs it off. And then it's just that hard cut to just gunfire going off and just people screaming.
There's a fade to black.
Yeah. But it's still like, I love that transition of just goes from him kind of like thinking to himself, like, I think I can actually get away with this. Like, it's that really is what you feel like. That's his last emotion you see is I think I'm going to actually get out of this alive.
So I guess let me ask you this. I feel like a lot of the downfalls of the heroes in these types of movies, in the noir and in the Western, are that when they finally get cocky, and his character doesn't seem overly cocky throughout the movie. He doesn't brag about anything, but like, you've obviously picked up some sort of arrogance or confidence in his plan,
yeah,
in his planning. So we see that, but also, why do you think that we aren't treated to seeing it? It's an unusual move to basically take out something that would probably be the climax of a movie completely out.
Yeah.
Is it because that the Mexicans are like less important to the plot? I mean, I know it's a main character and he gets killed off by essentially nobodies.
Yeah. I don't even know that that's the reason why necessarily because they treat them as like lesser characters.
It's not important to see the scene.
Yeah, I almost just kind of took it as, yeah, it's not even about him getting killed, because it is just more everyone's reaction to it, like what happens after that. Like, his death is somewhat inconsequential in like the end final picture. Like, it almost, I feel like they almost treat it as like it was inevitable that he was gonna die, so what's the point of even showing it? Like almost like telling the audience, come on, you knew this guy was going to get killed at some point.
Well, if you say it's inevitable, what's the point? That kind of seems to be the struggle of the movie.
Yeah.
Mostly with Tommy Lee Jones's sheriff character.
I mean,
it's like the inevitability of evil things happening.
That is it. I mean, Josh Brolin, you know, he gave his line in Thanos, but I feel like the line is definitely fitting of Javier Bardem, is like is literally just, I am inevitable. Like, it was always, from the moment that he gets involved, and that seems to be his character, is like a shark that always keeps moving. We never see him stay in one place for hardly any time. He's always constantly moving. Like, it almost
it makes things more tense.
It's making me think of like It Follows. Like, he is like that. He is like the character, the like demon or monster in It Follows. He's always constantly walking towards you, and he will not stop until he finally kills you. And then he's just going to keep going after somebody else. He is an inevitable force.
I mean, I know we just keep breaking down these scenes, but to me, they're simple and brilliant, such as the second hotel where he goes in and he gets his room and he gives him money. And he's like, trust me, it's not illegal. I'm not running from the cops, but can you please give me a call if anyone else shows up? Like, what do you mean by anyone else? And he's like, like a swinging dick, like obviously like somebody that's kind of a threat,
yeah,
threatening person. And he gets, he wakes up in the middle of the night and he has that sense that like somebody's out in the hallway. And I just love the tension where like he calls the main office and there's no answer at all when the guy told him that he was going to be there all night. So it's just like this really tense, creepy moment with him like shutting off his light, and then you see the feet at the bottom of the door, and he's ready to just blast them away.
And as the audience, we know that he's going to shoot the lock out, and he does not. Like how you're saying, it's kind of, that is where it's a comedic moment, because he is so like shocked that that's what happens to him. He does have that.
I don't even think he registers what happened to him.
Yeah. Cause like we've seen him do that, you know, two or three times by now. We've seen him do it at multiple people's houses. We've seen him do that. So it's like the audience knows what's going to happen, but Josh Brolin has not seen this happen yet. And he doesn't realize that that's what's going to happen. So it is such like a shock. Like, what was that?
From that moment on, it's like 5 minutes of, you don't ever see Shigar. He's always like, it feels like a horror film all of a sudden, like a slasher or something. Cause he jumps out the window. He's kind of hurt from his jump. He's being shot at, and then, like, he just can't get away from the guy. He goes through the lobby, and Shigar's, like, all, like, still on the same floor, but on the other side of the building.
He's also
shooting at him.
He's also very much, and I feel like this is probably another intentional thing from the Coens. They almost, they film him and have him play almost like the Terminator. I mean, he even does, like, exactly like the first Terminator, like, when he goes to the hotel room to, like, clean all his wounds after getting shot up or something like that. Like, he goes in and he has the drugs to you know, heal himself and stuff. So they 100% film him almost exactly like James Cameron shoots the Terminator, of just, he's just always there. He's always coming right at you.
And that moment where he flags down the truck and jumps in, and he's like, I won't hurt you. He doesn't even get to explain himself before the guy like shot and then threw the neck.
Yeah.
And that, like, really, like, he's trying to, like, steer the truck without being able to see out the windshield and wrecking. Again, it's just, like, I love how he, like, gets far away from, he moves out of the way of the truck, but Shigar sees the blood and knows that he's exited. I do love that moment, too, where Josh Brolin opens fire on him and he, like, leaps, which is, like, the most movement that you see out of this character.
The most rapid movement, like everything else is him just slowly stalking. Like, yeah,
it makes me think of like Cape Fear or something, but like it's just a great like ridiculously over the top, and he manages to get away in that moment too. And then you have like, yeah, I don't know, there's just so many moments in here that are like, yeah, I think for the most part everything is simplified, which I think makes it fantastic. Like, blow up the car, distract everybody in the pharmacy, and steal the drugs that you need. I'm also a big fan of when they're trying to figure out what weapon Shigar has, and they're like there's an entry wound but not an exit wound.
You think he was rooting around in there with a pocket knife?
Yeah, but there's no bullet in there.
And his deputy's like, just like, I don't even want to think about that. And he's like, well, I don't want to either, but you know.
Like, you brought it up.
Yeah. Tommy Lee Jones, he's fantastic in this movie, and he's just always like this outside observer. Like, he doesn't really get involved in the main plot all that much. He's kind of a, he gives like the opening narration and he gives the final lines of the film. So he is always kind of just like this just constant observer of everything around him. And you kind of get this interesting information.
He's like a more interactive Sam Elliott.
Yeah. 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 From the Big Lebowski. Yeah. And he does have a lot of good moments, and I do just love his characterization. Like, when they show up at the house and Anton Chigurh was drinking that milk out of the fridge, and they're just like, oh, son of a bitch, it's still sweating. He was just here. They're like, we got to call this in. And when he just sits down and goes, call what in? Guy drinking milk. And he just pours himself a glass. Like, he has those constant little,
I like, that's another thing where he's smart. Like, what are we going to call when we don't have any other information?
We don't know who this was. We don't know anything.
But he makes me think of like also one of those detectives that like he's drinking the milk, like to put himself in the mindset of the killer. That's kind of like how I took it, is like, he's like, what's this guy thinking?
They do the same shot of him looking at himself in the TV that's turned off. And he says like, well, he saw the same things I'm seeing. So what was different? He has that other, they keep asking, like, the DEA agents are going out to that crime scene, wanted to know if you wanted to go. Are there more bodies?
There's a similar shot later. It's not through the reflection of the TV, but it's when they go to the crime, when he, Tommy Lee Jones shows up at the crime scene to like investigate Lou and Dave, I did it. Lou and Moss's death. And he, when he first opens that door and Shigar is behind it, his shadow is like the exact same as like the reflection in the TV, where like it's even kind of blurred because it's all like the different lights.
Yeah.
And there's some sort of connection between those two moments that, you know, I guess is supposed to make the hairs on the back of your neck stand up. Like he knows that, like he knows it's past his time, more than it just being the title of the movie. But yeah, I also kind of like the idea of times are getting more violent than they've ever been before. And then when you end up when he ends up talking to his uncle, I think it's his uncle.
I think who that was supposed to be. Yeah.
He talks about his other uncle and how, and it's this moment of like, essentially things have always been violent, if not more violent. Yeah. And it's almost never changed. And I think we're kind of experiencing a similar thing right now, at least like me and you and all of our listeners, because we see these like shootings and killings and stuff every day. And I'm under the impression too that like, yeah, things might be easier, you know, like it's probably easier for that kid to get a firearm and shoot up wherever he decides to shoot up. But we're also hearing more about all this like smaller violent actions that normally like wouldn't hit us so rapidly. Like we hear everything like this happened. That's why like everything is every day. And I'm thinking statistically there would have to be violence like that every day. Because like Lou and Moss isn't necessarily a good person. I think he's like the area of gray that most people would be. You know, like I'm looking out for my family, but I'm going to take this money that nobody's going to miss. Yeah. And then Shigar's got that like classic villain, doesn't see themselves as the villain. I mean, he knows he's evil.
Yeah. But I think he does like view it as, yeah, almost like it is just it's a job. And when he accepts a payment for it, like it has to be done. The way he puts it in that final scene with him and Kelly MacDonald, like, well, I made this deal with your husband. And she's confused by that. And he's like, no, I made a deal with him. I said I wouldn't kill you if he agreed to do what I told him to. And he wanted, and how he puts it, he was more interested in saving himself than saving you.
Which I don't think is exactly true. But, you know, with the way that he's...
Yeah, it's not exactly true. But again, that's leading into how we were saying, like...
He's a man of his word.
That's when Llewellyn starts kind of being more cocky and stuff like that. Like that scene when he's like, no, I don't think you understand who you're messing with, kind of, to yeah. Anton Chigurh. And to which like Javier Bardem seems to just be like, I don't know, buddy. I really feel like you don't understand who you're talking to right now. You're like, you definitely, and I don't know. Part of that, I also think too, might just be that almost maybe because he's not the Tommy Lee Jones character. He doesn't have the big picture of just how bad this guy is. Like he knows this guy is hunting him and he's like been shooting at him, but you do get that sense that maybe he just doesn't fully understand that this guy's killed like 12 people by the time we're at this point in the movie. And he has killed people over much smaller things than stealing money from his bosses or something like that. Like he's killed people for much less than this. And maybe,
yeah, like
maybe
when
that's
he's
why.
Broken down and the guy tries to help him jump his car, he's like, can you get the chickens out of here? Yeah. And he's like, what?
That's another great moment. And I like the implied cut. Yeah, we don't see what happens. It just cuts to him hosing out the bed of the truck with all the feathers.
That's another thing that I like too, because why does it matter? But in his mind, he's like, he's got to clean it up for some reason.
Come on, you can't be driving around with a truck bed full of chicken feathers. Yeah, I feel like that's... Again, that's another... I do think they keep going.
It'd be distracting to other people if feathers are flying out the back of the truck.
They do keep... this movie is a very violent film, but it doesn't necessarily... Like how we were saying, it doesn't show you all of the people being killed. We're just told about how these people got killed. We're told about how the night manager got killed, but we don't actually see it. Like I feel like it's a good moment of, restraint from the Coens to not... And again, it also I feel like is just the inevitability of, we knew he was going to kill that guy, so what's the point of even showing it? Like, you know he's going to kill the guy with the chickens in the bed of his truck. Why do you have to show it? you know he's going to get the hotel and he's probably going to kill the hotel guy in the lobby. So why even show it? Even we don't really see.
I also don't think it's. I don't necessarily think that they don't show it because it's not important. Obviously, it works without showing it. As we know, the mind is much more fucked up than anything that we can see. So by never showing anything, it's like it's worse.
Yeah. But when he does finally get to that final scene with Kelly MacDonald, there's enough of it there that you almost think that they kind of leave it almost like for you to wonder, did he kill her or not? But I think the moment that like seals it or makes you, or at least makes me think, is when he checks his boots, because the only thought there is that he's checking his boots to make sure he didn't step in any blood as he was leaving.
100%. Like there's
that,
no,
that's like the one big key, because it just stops when he says that line of when he flips the coin and she says she doesn't want to call it. And he's like, come on. And she's like, I'm not leaving it up to a coin. It's your choice. And when he says that, I got here the same way the coin got here.
Well, when he kills Woody Harrelson's character and he's like, he makes a point not to step in the blood.
Yeah. Yeah. Puts his legs up on the couch.
Yeah. And then that's when Lou and Moss makes the call to Woody Harrelson. So they end up talking to each other. That's when he essentially, you know, makes that deal with him. So it all correlates to that. That moment correlates to her moment. He definitely kills her. Like, I don't think I was like, they've set up everything in the story visually. She's definitely dead because he's a man of his word and he's got to follow through, even though he already has the money. He's already retrieved it. Also kind of like his exit, where it's like he has everything, he's escaped, and then he essentially gets almost taken out by a person that accidentally ran a red light. Like, not even just coincidence, I guess, you know?
Yeah.
And I do like those kids, and he's got his bones sticking out of his arm.
Yeah, the kid from the kid that played Banshee in X-Men.
Yeah.
It's like, oh man, look at that bones. He just keeps repeating that over and over. There's like, half that's mine. You still got your shirt.
That's not what he gave us the money for.
Like, doesn't matter. I still don't have a shirt.
Yeah. He kind of just locks off into, you know, just that monster's always out there kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then that's when we get to Tommy Lee Jones, where he gives his like semi convoluted dreams, which I always think is just like a weird, it's a weird place to end the movie, because essentially he's the narrator, and in the beginning of the movie, it's voiceover, and he's talking about, you know, evil like Shiger, and I feel like he's also talking about evil inevitability at the end when he's talking about the dream that he's had with his wife, or his two dreams. Inevitability is the word that you brought up earlier, and that's kind of what I feel. It's like things have always been this way, and they're always going to be that way. And the Coen brothers are like, and that's our dark movie. Hopefully you enjoyed it.
Yeah, I do love this movie. I would say, if I were to say for their comedies, what's my favorite is probably Big Lebowski. And then, if I had to say what's their best, like, more non-comedy film, even though they threw a comedy into a lot of stuff, it probably is this film. It's one that's gotten better every time I've rewatched it. And again, it came out the same year as There Will Be Blood, which is my favorite
Zodiac
movie. Yeah, there was a lot of good movies that year. And I would even say all three of those movies, I've watched them again and again over the years since they've come out. And like I don't want to say it's one of the few times, but those movies do just keep getting better every time I watch them. Like, there's nothing that I don't know how three of these movies came out in the same year.
It's also one of the years too where for the Academy Awards, I felt like a good film had won.
Yeah.
And it's weird because this was one of the movies, like, when I saw it in theaters, I loved it. And I was like, right off the bat, I thought that it was fucking great. Same with Zodiac. But the strange thing was, I enjoyed There Will Be Blood, but I think There Will Be Blood's like the better film because it had that 2001 Space Odyssey effect on me, where every time I watch it, I think it's way better than it was. Like, it just keeps getting increasingly better.
Yeah.
And with No Country and Zodiac, it's like the appreciation's still there, but I mean, it definitely deserved it. It definitely deserves its win too.
That's definitely one of those years when
I don't, you that didn't actually, care. You're like, no, they all
that actually that like feels like going back to it, it's weird. That feels like going back to a time when like you would watch the Academy Awards and it's like, I've actually seen all these movies. They played them in theaters where I could watch them before the show. And I've seen these films and I know what they're about, and that I was actually, it was one of those that I even at the time, I still thought that There Will Be Blood was the better movie, 'cause I was just really into that movie.
Did you see that? I still theaters?
Do love it. Yeah.
That was one of the movies that I missed in theaters. And when it was coming out, if you remember this, it was originally going to come out on HD DVD.
Oh yeah.
The format that was up against Blu-ray.
The one that died.
And they canceled it, and then it was like pushed a month for them to make Blu-rays of it. And that's still the Blu-ray. That's still the one that I have of it.
Yeah.
Actually, that's really funny too, because it's like my No Country for Old Men Blu-ray. I'm like, this has to be one of the first Blu-rays I bought, and I'm sure it was like a $25 Blu-ray.
I still, and just it's like the most basic looking DVD. Thing.
Yeah.
I just watched it on HBO Max. I just did that since it was streaming on there.
Yeah, last night I was on HBO Max and I saw it was there too, even though that's not the way that I watched it.
I also saw The Last Duel is on there, and I was like, did they just drop that on there and not even tell anyone that they put it on HBO Max to watch?
Well, I bought The Last Duel, I want to say, the week after Christmas.
Yeah.
I also got Steph That Ron's Gone Wrong.
Yeah.
And that was on Disney Plus and then HBO Max, and I'm like, oh my god, I'd still buy it.
Yeah.
I would still purchase it, but I thought that it was just like so accessible, and at the moment it wasn't.
That's like how they put the new Ghostbusters on for streaming. Like you can get it on like Apple TV or Prime Video for $20, and then it's like or it's coming out February 1st. So I'm like, well, I'll just wait 2 weeks.
I'm a little disappointed. I'm going to sound like a fucking nerd, but I was hoping that they would have a better 4K version coming out. Like, I know it doesn't really just take away from the movie, especially something I haven't seen, but it's literally the worst cover art I've seen in a long time on a movie. Yeah,
it's that generic photoshopped poster.
It's like they drew it on. Yeah, this looks awful.
Yeah.
But No Country for Old Men, it's... I feel like the Coens go more towards a dark comedy, and this is the one that's like obviously this more serious than anything else.
Yeah, this is the one that I even there are other ones that get more serious that they've mixed in there. Yeah, this is almost maybe since like Blood Simple, but even that has good like comedy mixed into it. But yeah, they've always like
the
kind of
slapstick with the guy that won't die.
Yeah, they throw that in there. This is definitely the one that it feels like, yeah, they did tone it down. And I feel like it's also partially just the source material. And maybe they just respected that too much, because it's Cormac McCarthy and all of his stuff, like The Road and all of his films, all of his books are super dark and not very comedic. So I don't know if that was also just like they didn't want to just randomly put their kind of that kind of humor into this film. Like they just respected it too much to kind of add on to it.
I read The Road. I have No Country for Old Men, but I didn't read it. Only got it a little bit ago. But The Road was interesting because they didn't give anybody dialogue in the movie. So, like, there was no, like, quotations that people were speaking.
Yeah.
So I always thought it was interesting to see what they interpreted as dialogue and what they didn't interpret. Like, what was thought and what was dialogue when it ended up on the screen. Because there was no indication of which was which when you're reading the book.
Yeah.
And I feel like No Country for Old Men, it's probably the same style. And that's probably why it's almost a completely visual. Like, that's I think that's the biggest appeal to this movie. And honestly, that's probably the biggest appeal to, you know, its competition. Like, There Will Be Blood. It's a dense movie. There's a lot to take in. And I think that's why repeated viewings help.
Yeah.
But everything's visual. There's very few cues where like you can pick up on these characters by what they're saying. Most of it is by their actions and what they're doing. But yeah, I think this is one of my favorites from them. I don't know if it's necessarily because it was like the right time. I watched Fargo kind of like after Fargo was big, because when Fargo came out, I would have been like 10 years old. Although thinking about it, because I watched the new one last night, Scream, I was obsessed with Scream, and I would have been the same age, because I think that's the same year that those movies came out. You know, slasher versus the North Dakota crime movie. And I think that's another movie, too, where I know we're not necessarily talking about it, but it's probably the most similar to No Country for Old Men. When you get to the end and they're, you know, they're feeding the body into the wood chipper, I think it's so much more violent because it's been kind of a goofy movie still. Even though we've seen murders and they've been pretty violent, these criminals are kind of like goofballs. Not to keep bringing it up, but we do, and I'm doing it right now. Yeah. But Home Alone, they're just like a more violent version of Harry and Marv.
Yeah. I think another movie to watch if people enjoy this, too, is I got the same feeling like Hell or High Water. It kind of goes into the same direction of with again, Jeff Bridges who's worked at the Coen brothers.
Same genre.
Yes, it's very similar. Like they kind of throw those noir elements into a Western, into that one. And, you know, again, you kind of have that sheriff that's just always on the outside. He's always just kind of viewing the aftermath of all of their crimes. He's not always really there with them at the moment.
I watched a thing on Criterion Channel last year that was noir Westerns. Blood on the Moon really stands out to me. So they exist. They've been around for a while.
Yeah.
I guess these are more like the neo versions of them, where, like, you know, not necessarily getting like the hard lighting, but you are getting some interesting shots. Like Dusk is shot very, very weird, where, like, I don't know if very weird's the right wording to it. But for example, when Lewin goes back to the crime scene to give that guy water and he looks at his truck, that shot of just his truck where the bottom half of the screen's black and the top of the half, sorry, I'm slightly colorblind, like a blue purple, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's just this like dusk skyline and you only have this little sliver of the skyline where you see like the hills and the truck. And that's it. So your eyes just focus directly on the truck. And I think that's what this movie is like filled with. Like lots of little clever shots like that where an audience doesn't think about it, but the directors are telling you exactly where you need to be looking at all times.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is some dog murder in this. There's post-mortem and kind of like live action dog murder. It just builds with all these tense moments too. When he's swimming away from the dog and the dog's like chasing him down and he's got to like load the gun that hopefully fires because he's just been in the water. I would say overall, I do kind of feel like it is probably their best movie, or at least it's my favorite movie. And sometimes it's kind of hard to figure out the difference between best and favorite.
Yeah, I know what you're saying there.
I just think that it's such a great movie if you're trying to study tension or just how to tell something visually. I think that almost everything, like you could watch this movie on mute and I don't think that you would miss too much. Maybe you'd miss a little bit of how the detectives are piecing things together.
You'd miss Tommy Lee Jones' story about the cattle in the slaughterhouse getting murdered.
Yeah.
And I love when she calls back in. Was that true? Was what true? That story you told? What story? And he's like, oh, well,
it was true that it
I couldn't
was
say,
story.
Yeah, I couldn't say 100% all the facts. It's true that it is a story.
Well, you know what's funny about that? That's kind of a callback to Fargo, because they say that it's based on true events, and the Coens said that they just threw that in there. Yeah. It's not based on anything. I don't know. There's just people that just get drawn to that, like, based on a true story shit.
There was that movie about it is a real life story of that woman that went to North Dakota because she thought there was treasure there. She was trying to find the actual the actual thing. Although then there's other people that say that they don't think that's what she was doing, but it is a very weird thing that she died in like the same area. And then they made a whole movie about that, about the woman watching Fargo in like Korea.
On VHS, like, yeah, thinking that it was like, yeah, a real thinking video. It's
based
was
on true events, and that she goes there to
it's
find
it's called
the
like
treasure.
Kamiko Treasure Hunter or something,
yeah,
like that.
I remember it had like an odd title. Like it was very descriptive of what the exact movie is. Trying to see if you have it.
Oh, I know I have it.
You just can't remember if that is the exact title.
I'm gonna peek and see. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Kamiko, the Treasure Hunter. Boom. It's fiercely original. That's what it says.
Yeah, at least that kind of is semi-based on true events.
Yeah. Well, it says it's the shockingly true story, and true is in quotation marks, so maybe it's not that true.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm sure a lot of it was them, like, a lot of assumptions had to be made on what she was actually doing.
Oh, the quote on the thinking front of the box, a very beautiful, deep, and touching film, Werner Herzog.
Oh, well, there you go. That's all you needed to say.
Next week, we're going to do True Grit, which is remake territory, but also maybe like their last, at least in my mind, like their last fully serious movie until you get to, I guess, technically Macbeth, but you're losing Cohen.
Losing a Cohen there.
And Buster Scruggs has some serious segments in it, yeah, but like it opens with the goofiest segment of all time.
Even True Grit though does do a lot of that. They build a lot of comic relief in just with, yeah, just with Jeff Daniels' character. He's again, he is essentially almost the dude just in the old West times. Like, so there's a lot of goofy stuff going on with just his character in particular. And we get Josh Brolin back for that film.
I'm kind of losing my timeline, though, because I feel like Burn After Reading is probably before True Grit.
Yeah, it is. That's 2008.
But what was between True Grit and Buster Scruggs?
Llewellyn Davis.
Oh, yeah.
And then
I love that movie, too. That's a great movie.
When's A Serious Man from?
Like,
is that before Burn After Reading?
It might have been right after. It's definitely the same time.
I couldn't remember if it was. I knew it's close to it, but I couldn't remember for sure where it actually fell in their timeline. Nope, that was right after Burn After Reading, and right before.
So it's
True
like
Grit.
2008's Burn, 9's Serious Man, and 10's True Grit.
True Grit, and then yeah, inside Llewellyn Davis, then Hail Caesar.
Hail Caesar's
the other one we weren't thinking of, and then Buster Scruggs.
Well, I knew I wasn't thinking of him because I'm like not. There wasn't 8 years with nothing there.
But yeah. Yeah, they were doing something.
It would actually be kind of interesting if, because we're doing directors, and I think almost, at least out of these first four directors that we've chosen to do, we could literally do like a sequel year, like the following year we could do, if we wanted to, we could do like the exact same director, but different movies easily. There's so much for Coens. We could do Coens part two, part three.
Yeah.
Let's see how that all comes together. But yeah, if you oddly haven't seen it, Chuck said it's on HBO Max. It's probably in 4K on there.
Yeah.
It's my assumption, at least.
It looked good when I watched it.
Looked good when I watched it, too. It aged well. I mean, there's not much that could go. I mean, the CG of the elk or whatever wasn't the greatest, but I mean, that's about it. It's like only thing that it suffered from. If you're like a purist like that and you think that would take you out of the movie, it's not the worst. But yeah, it's one of my favorite dramas, or that like modern Western, definitely. And yours too.
Yeah.
We'll be back next week, as we always do, with True Grit. We're Cinema D'Amore. We're at Cinema D'Amore on Twitter. I'm at JJMorgan19 on Twitter.
ChuckFinn66.
/CinemaD'Amore on Facebook. That's where you get all our nice ads. And I don't know, Chuck, who do you think's next? What director do you think we're doing next?
You know what? I'd probably have to even look at my notes there.
You don't even know?
I always forget. I don't know what we're doing next month.
Oh, you're probably right if you were to make a guess. Yeah. So keep everybody on their toes. I don't even know if I have a hint, because that would have been cool.
get one ready for the next episode.
I mentioned one of their movies in this episode, and that's all. It's something to linger on. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
We are Cinema D'Amore. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter to stay up to date with news and information on upcoming episodes. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audible, Pandora, Alexa, or iHeartRadio. It would be greatly appreciated if you subscribe to our podcast on your platform of choice. We also appreciate feedback, so rate us, review us, and let us know what you think. And above all else, thank you for listening.